for the very wise and articulate Vice Admiral McCain. I was a midshipman with 6 months still to go in the Naval Academy when Pearl Harbor occurred, and I've never been to South Vietnam. I feel somewhat like my experience in commissioning the Dewey, when after a week or so aboard, it came time to hold my first commanding officer's inspection. Like any new ship, I had received numbers of brand new boots right out of boot camp, who had been taken well in hand by the chief of the ship, the chief petty officer, who was responsible and sometimes somewhat sternly for squaring away these brand new young lads. This particular young seaman recruit had apparently been signed to keep the after head clean, and his chief petty officer had ducked in two or three times to say, "Have you seen the captain?" And suddenly I appeared making my rounds. And the seaman said, "Sir, are you the captain?" And I said, "Yes, why?" And he said, "Boy, are you going to catch hell. The chief's been looking all over the ship for you." Today, almost to this very hour, a few hours earlier, the Japanese plane swept in over Pearl Harbor and initiated the war, killing 1,000 or more of our naval personnel. The United States almost immediately declared war on Japan and her two allies, Germany and Italy. Our industries were marshaled, our youth were mobilized. We seized the initiative on the seas and maintained control of the seas, projected our power over into the continents, and within 4 years had defeated all three of the fascist dictatorships at a cost of over 250,000 U.S. lives. I hold that the attack on Pearl Harbor represents a catastrophic failure in the foreign policy of the United States. A failure to have the military power to support our foreign policy. We knew what we wanted, us and our allies, but the democracies in Europe and the United States at home lacked the resolve as a people to produce those forces. Fascist aggression began a slice at a time. It was put up with for a while until finally, almost too late, they were overturned. Today, we have casualties coming in daily from South Vietnam. And we have to ask ourselves on this somber note whether another failure of foreign policy has occurred. And in order to answer that, the first question we have to ask ourselves is, what do we want as a nation? And over how long a pull? I think even those who are protesting in parades would agree that this nation wants to maintain its freedom and its way of life, and that we would want other sovereign nations to be able to choose freely their way of life. And if we agree on that, I think we have to concede that what this world needs is a stable world community of nations in which there is respect for law and order. I think also that even the most militant of us military men would agree that we want to avoid the destruction of the human race that can result from the uncontrolled use of the terrible weapons now in our possession and to come into our possession. And the next major question we have to ask ourselves then is, how do we accomplish these aims? And for this we have to go back, I think, to World War II and find out how we got where we are, because we are accomplishing those aims today. We didn't start out right at the end of World War II. We demobilized almost overnight and changed ourselves from the status of the most powerful nation on earth to one that was no longer able to control its foreign policy. Stalin, on the other hand, did not propose to lose the ability to shape the destiny of the Soviet Union and maintained his forces. And within a relatively short period of time, by application of military power either directly or indirectly, the Soviet Union toppled the nations of Central Europe until, by the most heroic form of bluff, coupled with the use of a relatively small stockpile, the threatened use of a relatively small stockpile of nuclear weapons, the United States and her allies were able to stop the encroachment. There again, after the war, we began to dream of the kind of world we wanted, but we didn't maintain the power to create it. And then there began a period of enlightenment in this country and amongst our allies. The first major step occurred when this country was forced as an absolute urgent military requirement to pick up the bricks for the British in the Mediterranean. In 1947, when the Turks and Greeks were being beleaguered by the communists, with actually insufficient forces to do so, we challenged the communists. We know today from the book Conversations with Stalin, written by Tito's communist confidant, Milovan Gilas, that Stalin told the members of his Politburo the United States would never permit the Mediterranean sea lines of communication to be severed. Yet, like a Machiavellian mother with children spawned by the devil, he permitted his Politburo to continue their experiment until we put our forces in. And then rather rapidly, the rebellion in Greece was liquidated and the pressures on Turkey withdrawn. The second significant step on the part of this nation was the realization that we needed allies, strong and healthy overseas, which led to the very enlightened decision to pour billions of dollars in the Marshall Plan into the countries of Western Europe. You will recall that initially the offer was made to all the nations of Europe, communist and otherwise, and only the West accepted. And out of that decision, and the burgeoning economies that resulted, and the strong industries that resulted, armed forces sprang into being again in Europe, with which we have become allied in the NATO organization, the most effective peacetime alliance in history, and as a result of which, Soviet pressures in Europe have become very small indeed. A third major and dramatic step was the decision to go into Korea. Here was a case where far more than the need to hold that territory for any strategic value, it was important to establish again the concept that a stable world cannot be maintained if naked aggression is not repelled. And again, with insufficient forces, we went in, we held on by our teeth while building them up, and thanks to the lesson we learned there, the United States has never again cut her forces back to the extent we did at the end of World War II. Another important concept came out of the Korean War, and one which is frequently argued, and that was the concept of a limited war, of the application of power just to the extent necessary to win a particular aim. Now, many of us military men may well think that the United States should have gone further at that particular point. But none of us, I think, would have advocated an invasion of China or an invasion of the Soviet Union. The argument only stems around how much force do you use and how far do you go to teach the lesson that you want to teach. And as a result of what we learned there, in successive crises such as Lebanon, Quemoy, Suez, and recently the Dominican Republic, the United States has learned to put her power where her foreign policy is, as a result of which, in many cases, we haven't even had to lose a man. Now, while this was going on around the perimeter of the free world, fantastic military developments were taking place at the center of the two superpowers. You recall, of course, that the United States and the UK ended the war with fission weapons. And shortly thereafter, the United States acquired the hydrogen or fusion weapons. The Soviet Union crossed both thresholds shortly thereafter. France and very recently Communist China have crossed the fission threshold and will, in a matter of time, acquire hydrogen weapons. Our studies indicate that in the course of the next 10 years, as many as 10 or 15 of the industrialized nations of the world have the capability to produce these nuclear weapons. And we face the prospect that over the long haul, some very small nation in possession of nuclear weapons can trigger off a nuclear holocaust if this spread is not brought to a halt. After the failure of Mr. Baruch's plan to disarm or to control nuclear weapons, three successive presidencies have agreed that this country must maintain absolutely invulnerable strategic nuclear striking forces in order that any first strike on this country can be replied to with such overwhelming force that no one would dare initiate the first strike. And today we have in place Minutemen, and more importantly, because they are 100% survivable, the Polaris missiles on our Polaris submarines that see all around the periphery of Eurasia. Perhaps the great watershed that convinced the Soviet Union of the superiority against which they were operating was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Here, of course, the Soviet Union sought to, by a sneak and cheap move, double the megatonnage that they could bring to bear on this country and cut in half the warning time. In addition to which, had they been successful, they would have, of course, achieved a tremendous political victory and rubbed our noses in the mud throughout the world. And when, as Mr. Rusk suggested, the Soviet Union and the United States stood eyeball to eyeball until they finally blinked, you can be very sure that it was because they had made the rational calculation that they had no choice. One of my jobs in connection with that particular crisis was to calculate what the casualties might have been. I estimated 300 million had the nuclear weapons been exchanged. The United States proved to the Soviet Union at that time, right down in their viscera, that we had the nuclear superiority. But perhaps of equal importance was that, having decided that, the Soviet Union had to make another decision. They had to decide whether or not they could take us on with conventional forces. And the forces of the United States Navy, ringed around the island of Cuba, made it absolutely impossible for them to consider it. And furthermore, they knew that with what we had to bring to bear all over the world, they couldn't try pressures in any other area. A rather remarkable change occurred in Soviet foreign policy as a result of this confrontation. I was in the arms control business at the time, and rather rapidly we began to receive new and interesting signals from the Soviet embassies. They began to send through little messages to diplomats here and there about how a test ban treaty might be worked out that could be of value to both sides. And this administration, after going at great lengths to be sure that the Joint Chiefs of Staff agreed with the military aspect of the negotiation, did work out such a test ban treaty. Now, this treaty does more than ease the psychological concern of the people of the world against poisoning of the atmosphere. It really is a contract between someone we don't like very well and don't trust and ourselves. And the point of the contract is to try to find out, with something of a relatively harmless nature, whether or not it's possible to work out rules for survival with an arch enemy. There is a very important reason for the Soviet Union to want this to work. They are as worried as the United States about the diffusion of nuclear weapons. They look across the border at Communist China, who isn't very friendly, and they know that Communist China is going to be able to strike them with nuclear weapons before she can strike us. And so down the road somewhere, it may be possible for the two superpowers, without in any sense trusting each other, to work out a set of rules that helps to protect them from new threats. Well, now, having achieved as a result of this national consensus that we needed military power to support our foreign policy, having achieved deterrence at both the strategic level and the conventional level, indeed even the Communist Chinese appeared to be constrained by that, as evidenced by the Quemoy crisis and their pulling back in India, there then emerged a new threat. Chairman Khrushchev, in a famous policy speech, suggested that wars of strategic nuclear strikes were bad, conventional wars were bad, but wars of national liberation were good. By that he meant, of course, wherever we can find conditions conducive to rebellion and put communist agents in and begin to supply them with money and supplies and take over the country and take it away from the free world bloc and put it into the communist bloc, we'll do it, because this looks like something we can do without having our hand called. And so the real threat we face today is how, having achieved deterrence at the two higher levels, we can stop aggression at the sublimited level. And here two policies run into conflict. We all agree, I think, that we need to maintain a stable world order, and that means repelling aggression. And yet many of our idealists in this country, many of the college professors, try to tell us that what we're doing is denying the right of these people in South Vietnam to take over by revolution, even as we did. What they miss, I think, is the fact that we're really protecting the right of South Vietnam to have a revolution and any other country that we maintain within the free world bloc. Because once communism takes over, no future rebellion ever succeeds. Now, what are the policy and power tools that we have to bring to bear in this struggle? Well, first, the United States has developed a new and, I think, much more refreshing approach to the international law. Perhaps we should even call it to the concept of molding world opinion. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we were in terrible trouble, the doctrine of quarantine was developed, a use of blockade in peacetime, and it was accepted by the world at large. Surveillance became legitimized. Recall the hue and cry when the U-2 was shot down over the Soviet Union. Today, as you well know, surveillance flights are made over enemy territory, and the world, by and large, has come to accept it. The concept of the United States acting as an executive agent for a regional organization was perfected. And of more pertinence to the struggle in Vietnam, recently the doctrine of reprisals has been developed, and after some initial baying on the part of those who were concerned, the world by and large and public opinion has come to accept it. Stop to consider that just 3 years ago it would have been almost impossible for the president to get support for the daily strikes against North Vietnam. Today we are striking daily a sovereign country which pretends not to be at war with us and which pretends not to be aiding and abetting the rebellion in South Vietnam, and the world public opinion is standing up to it. We have molded the concept of how to maintain world order and stability to our ends for legitimate purposes. Now, what kinds of power tools do we have to bring to bear in this struggle? Well, the first one was the use of advisors to help the people themselves over there. This concept worked very well in the case of the Hak Revolution in the Philippines and in Malaysia and in other places where sea power was able to cut down or hold to a trickle the logistic supply of the communist rebellion. In South Vietnam, with its very large and amorphous border against North Vietnam, it has to date been impossible to cut off these supplies. Furthermore, the North Vietnamese have escalated and introduced armed, organized cadres of their own, and therefore the United States has had to use a second tool, and that is specially tailored forces. Initially the Marines, which of course had the most rapid response rate, and later the Army, and we are in there not only now advising the South Vietnamese, but doing some fighting of ourselves, a very serious and important degree. And meanwhile, through the use of carrier air power and TAC air, reprisals are being conducted daily against North Vietnam in an effort to cut down the trickle of supplies. Notice the care with which these reprisals were applied. Initially, the United States started just north of the border, worked up toward Hanoi, around, and toward the Chinese Communist border. The effort here was to make it clear to the Chinese Communists that we were not going to initiate attack on them, to try also to get the message across to them, as I think it has, that they better not introduce troops of their own. Hanoi and Haiphong remain hostage. The question of whether or not they have to be attacked is moot, and it involves a question of judgment as yet to be determined. But the important thing is that for the first time in our long, long struggle against communism, the United States is using her power on the other side of the Iron Curtain. Up until this point, we've always had to fight these things on our side of the line. And now we have perfected a new technique, supported by world opinion, to go after them where we can hurt them. And I think it has wonderful possibilities for the future. Now, the question you ask yourself is, what happens next in South Vietnam? Here, of course, the real dilemma is Communist China. Without Communist China's support, North Vietnam, I think, would have folded long ago. It took 50 years for the Soviet Union to begin to get enough prosperity that she was a little bit worried about maintaining a stable world. It's undoubtedly going to take that or longer for the Chinese Communists. That's the lifetime of these young heroic gentlemen here today. And yet it's not too short a period of time for us to be planning. In just 10 years, the Chinese communists will be able to strike us with intercontinental ballistic missiles, I would guess. Within 5 years, they probably would be able to strike our bases with short-range missiles. Within the next 2 years, I should guess, they might have the hydrogen weapon. And yet, throughout all that period and today, they remain our implacable foes, as suggested recently by their defense minister in his highly publicized speech, in which he said they were going to surround the city continents of the world by capturing first the country continents of the world. Well, now, to my mind, the picture of the Navy participation in this application of military power in support of our foreign policy has never been brighter. The Polaris is unquestionably the most important aspect of the strategic deterrent. When it came time to go in fast to bolster up the deteriorating situation in South Vietnam, it was the Marines that were ready and it was the Navy that put them there. Now we have the Army building up and beginning to bring her power to bear. The carriers were able to move wherever needed rapidly to bring their tactical air to bear on the point. Now we're beginning to get tactical air in, developing the field so that the Air Force tactical air can begin to fill a bigger role than it has been able to fill in the past. The Navy has been responsible for maintaining the surveillance of the whole seacoast and a great deal of the air surveillance. And the important thing is that all the time we're doing this, and while we're getting the Army and the Air Force increasingly committed to help liquidate this situation in South Vietnam, the Navy and the Marine Corps remain ready to move north or south wherever a new crisis calls them. As a matter of fact, should the Soviet Union, who has, as I suggested earlier, a deep investment in trying to maintain some degree of rapprochement with the United States, begin to act up, we have pressures, military forces available to bring pressures to bear wherever they're required. I would like to suggest what I think is the often most overlooked point in connection with all of our application of power around the world in support of our foreign policy. And that is that both in the Korean War and in the present war, the United States' control of the seas has never even been questioned by the enemy. I think it's very, very significant that they haven't even tried. I think their studies are just as effective as ours, that they better not dare to try. And I can't think on this Pearl Harbor Memorial Day of any finer memorial to the thousands who died both on that day and across the oceans and continents of the world than that this country has learned to maintain the military power required to support its foreign policy. And it's thanks to the help of the many, many citizens throughout the world, throughout this country, of whom you gentlemen are a significant percentage, that makes it possible for the Navy to continue to be able to maintain its forces. Thank you.